Thanks for downloading the report from BBC Radio 4. Here's Peter Oborne.
Britain is now bombing Syria. Our target, IS. We aim to disrupt their supply routes, take out their headquarters, destroy their infrastructure and wreck their training facilities. There is no intention to put British troops on the ground. This means that we depend on local forces. The Prime Minister thinks there are 70,000 so-called moderate fighters ready to join our battle, mostly in the form of the Free Syrian Army. In this week's report, I'm not going to get bogged down in the argument about whether this figure is accurate. I want to ask whether Britain and the West embarked on an unspoken alliance of convenience with militant jihadi groups, including Al-Qaeda, in order to pursue our long-held aim of destroying the Assad regime. I will reveal that charges against one terror suspect were dropped by the Crown Prosecution Service after he argued that he was fighting on the same side as the British. I will expose details of an astonishing attempt to rebrand Al-Qaeda as an organisation with which we can do business. And I will give examples of how David Cameron's moderates have fought battles alongside Al-Qaeda. It wouldn't be the first time that the West has exploited jihadis to pursue its own policy agenda.
The attack has had some success. One armoured patrol car has been hit by an anti-tank rocket and driven completely off the road. There are two live Russians near the APC.
This is exactly what happened after communist Russia invaded Afghanistan 35 years ago. Alistair Crook was a career MI6 officer who served in Afghanistan in the 1980s. He has a sense of déjà vu.
What we saw in Afghanistan 30 years ago was that the West didn't directly arm the fundamentalist groups, the extreme groups, some of which were to become Al-Qaeda. They used the Pakistani intelligence service and also the Saudi Arabian intelligence service. I remember being told in America when I complained, well, yes, Alistair, but you know these groups you're complaining about, they sure kick communist ass.
And they did play an important role in helping to drive the Russians out of Afghanistan. But then they turned on the West and our former partners were responsible for the atrocities of September the 11th, 2001.
I said at the beginning of what's happening in Syria that this is going to be worse. We are going to do exactly the same thing, and that is exactly what's happened. The West using jihadist groups in order to try and weaken and undermine Assad, and that has been a policy.
So what you're saying is something which will absolutely knock people here in Britain for six, that basically we've been knowingly supporting Al-Qaeda and jihadist groups in Syria in order to undermine Assad.
The West does not actually hand the weapons to Al-Qaeda, let alone to ISIS, but the system that they have constructed leads precisely to that end.
And how do they do that? Alistair Crook says that the so-called moderate allies of the West have played a critical role in arming jihadis.
The weapons conduit that the West directly has been given to groups such as the Syrian Free Army have been understood to be a sort of Walmart from which the more radical groups would be able to take their weapons and to pursue the jihad.
A Walmart, you mean that they act as a sort of supermarket?
There's a supermarket where people can go and take some weapons. So the weapons migrate along the line to the more radical elements. The policy was to use jihadists to weaken the government in Damascus and to drive it to its knees at the negotiating table.
What evidence is there to support Alistair Crook's shocking claim that the Free Syrian Army have been used as a means of distributing arms to the extremist elements among the Syrian rebels? Supporters of his claim pointed me to the case of Berlin Gildo. This Swedish national joined rebels in September 2012 as they battled for control of a military base near Aleppo, a crucial siege which involved both Free Syrian Army forces and Islamist groups. It's not clear which group he was with, but we've obtained this recording of him proudly singing about jihad. His singing is almost as bad as mine. Berlin Gildo did not want to talk to us, but his lawyer, Gareth Pearce, did. And what she told us does appear to support the claim that Free Syrian Army rebels have been used as a weapons supermarket for extremists.
Mr. Gildo's own observation was there will be trucks coming in. People refer to them as NATO trucks coming in from Turkey. The Free Syrian Army would unload them and ask for assistance from unloading, and the weapons will be handed out generally without any specificity as to the exact recipient.
And so what he says that he saw was guns, ammunition, etc., which had been theoretically destined to the Free Syrian Army, just being much more widely distributed.
Distributed to whoever was involved in particular battles.
The case of Berlin Gildo raises tantalising questions about possible Western complicity with Syrian jihadis. He returned from Syria with the support of Swedish intelligence, but almost 2 years later he was seized by British police while on transit through Heathrow Airport. He was imprisoned in Belmarsh after being charged with terrorist offences. But 6 months later, the charges were mysteriously dropped. Why? Berlin Gildo was planning to argue that he was on the same side as the British government itself.
His defence was never articulated. Before the case, it was argued on his behalf that to prosecute him constituted an abuse of process because the British government was doing the same thing. Was for political purpose, removal of the Assad regime, being involved in supplying the armed resistance with non-lethal support.
In fact, Gareth Pearce was going to argue that the British government went beyond its official policy of giving non-lethal aid, armoured vehicles, body armour, communications equipment and so on, to so-called moderates, and that they were aware of and potentially involved in secret operations to arm the rebels.
We argued that we had to have disclosure of British involvement, but we didn't get to that stage. The prosecution came back and said that there was nothing to disclose and there was, in any event, a policy of neither confirm nor deny in relation to the involvement of British intelligence services.
At the time, the Crown Prosecution Service offered no evidence following a review prompted by, quote, issues that had arisen. The case of Berlin Gildo is not isolated. Thousands of foreign fighters travelled to Syria in the early years of the Civil War, but one man's story in particular has uncanny similarities.
Police officer was waiting at the airport and they gave me a letter saying that the government believes you were involved in terrorist activity in Syria, therefore your passport is being confiscated. And that was it.
Are you put under arrest at that point?
No. I was arrested almost 3 months later and locked up as a dangerous terrorist suspect in Belmarsh.
The charges against Mersin Beg, a former prisoner at Guantanamo Bay, included attending a terrorist training camp in Syria. He had spent time with Ahrar al-Sham, one of the larger jihadi groups fighting Assad, where he told me that he had helped organise medical training and advice about how to defend civilians. Yet after 7 months in Belmarsh prison, the charges were suddenly dropped. Why? Mersin Beg had one very handy card to play. British intelligence had known all along about where he was going and who he was with.
Before my trip to Syria, the security services contacted me. We met eventually and they were concerned perhaps that if there were any Britons going over there and what they were doing there and if they come back, are they a threat to the United Kingdom? At that time, I don't think either of us felt that they was. And they said to me that if you go, there won't be any hindrance from us, we return journey.
They didn't object to your going, and they said there'd be no problem your coming back.
Yes, they didn't, and there was no objection then. There was no restriction.
British intelligence didn't necessarily know that Mersem Beg would end up helping the rebels, but he says they did know that he would spend time with the Islamist group Ahrar al-Sham because he told them.
I was very disappointed that the trial didn't go through. I believe I would have won. Helping to defend the civilian population is not terrorism, it's self-defense. And what I was doing and when I was doing it and when I'm accused of doing whatever I did was completely in line with British policy at the time.
The parallels are haunting. Just as with Berlin Gildo, Mersem Beg's defence would have been this. If he was guilty of terrorism, then so was the British state. As with Berlin Gildo, charges were suddenly dropped so that this defence has never been heard. And as with Berlin Gildo, Mersem Beg claims that the Brits had closer connections with Islamist groups than they were prepared to let on. Remember, it's long been Britain's policy to support the moderate opposition in their quest to remove Assad. However, Mersem Beg told me that the equipment funneled to this moderate opposition often ended up in the hands of jihadi groups, and he believes that the British must have known this.
I think the British could not have been unaware of the fact that they are sending non-lethal aid to the Free Syrian Army, who are clearly cooperating and sharing resources with the various Islamic groups. I think there can be no doubt about that.
Indeed, in December 2013, both Britain and the United States temporarily halted supplies for that very reason, after a Free Syrian Army warehouse was seized by a group called the Islamic Front. We only have Mersem Beg's word for what the intelligence services knew about his trip. However, evidence does appear to be emerging to support the claim that the Free Syrian Army has been used as a conduit for arms and support for the jihadi groups. Of course, that certainly doesn't mean that it was a deliberate policy.
Well, assalamu alaikum in Washington, Al-Asim al-Amriki, Anna Robert Ford.
Robert Ford, a fluent Arabic speaker, served as the American ambassador to Syria from the start of the conflict in early 2011. Though the embassy was closed in February 2012, he continued his work as ambassador from Washington, maintaining regular contact with opposition groups until his retirement last year.
We understood, even in the first quarter of 2012, that the extremist opposition fighters was growing, that they had more ammunition, they had more food, they could actually give their fighters money to help support families. And people were telling us that if the Americans didn't react, the extremists would grow stronger and stronger.
Robert Ford has long been calling for the West to do more to arm what he calls moderate rebels, initially in their battle against the Assad regime and now against IS. But even he admits that identifying moderates is very difficult.
We were very unhappy when one of the commanders of the Free Syrian Army, the colonel whom I had met, appeared in a picture standing next to this jihadi commander after they all together in a coordinated operation took a Syrian airbase in northwestern Syria. And I called him on the phone and I said, "That is extremely unfortunate and inappropriate when you're trying to get American help and you're clearly working with these people." And he said, "If you can't provide us any help, then shut up when we try to work with other people on the ground that you don't like. It's not your business."
A shocking admission by the Pentagon that the U.S. was only training about 60 Syrian opposition fighters to battle ISIS. Well below.
Last year, the U.S. Defense Department did start providing training and equipment to moderate rebels with assistance from the U.K. This led to one of the most notorious fiascos of the entire conflict and total humiliation for America. It's a story which suggests the Syrian moderates, beloved of the West, can't compete with better organised and more ruthless jihadi groups when they enter the Syrian battlefield.
The plan had been to train as many as 5,000 of these rebels within the first year of this program. They're not even close to that.
So what happened to those fighters who were carefully vetted by the US Defense Department and underwent special training in Turkey? In July, the first 54 were released into Syria, but within days, there were fewer than 10 left. The others were killed, captured, or fled. A second group entered Syria in September, but almost immediately handed over around a quarter of their equipment to Al-Qaeda, and there are reports that some may even have defected. This program has been suspended as a failure. Schemes to train and equip moderate rebels have a habit of going wrong, never more so than when the CIA is involved.
الله أكبر حركة حزم إطلاق صاروخ تاو على إحدى طائرات النظام الأسدي في مطار حلب الدولي الله أكبر
These bangs come courtesy of America's Central Intelligence Agency. Though never publicly acknowledged, it's credibly reported that America has been working closely with local allies to supply moderate fighting groups with heavy weapons. Charles Lister is a world-famous expert on the Syrian crisis. He's a visiting fellow at Brookings Doha Center and has interviewed over 100 rebels, many face-to-face, as part of his research.
There were a few groups in northern Syria who went through this process. One was known as Harakat Hazm. Another one's known as the Syrian Revolutionaries Front. And both of those organisations were very strongly supported, both by Saudi Arabia and by the Americans, by the CIA. And they had become the kind of cause célèbre of the moderate Free Syrian Army in Syria. Most famously, both groups had received large numbers of American anti-tank missiles. And they were the first recipients of these American-made missiles.
And what happened to the forces?
Both organisations were wholeheartedly militarily defeated by al-Nusra. What was left of them, they either defected, but many also fled to Turkey.
Al-Nusra, the Syrian affiliate of al-Qaeda, claims to have taken control of some of these American-made anti-tank missiles. So much for the Syrian Revolutionary Front. To be fair, some of the other 40 or so CIA-supported groups are reported to have been more successful, and others have been a lot more agile. Rather than fight against al-Qaeda, they fought alongside them. One example concerns the battle for Idlib, which until earlier this year was under the control of the Assad regime. The assault on the strategic northwestern town was led by Jaish al-Fatah, translated as Army of Conquest. Jaish al-Fatah was a coalition of several fighting groups, of which by far the most significant were Ahrar al-Sham and al-Nusra, or al-Qaeda to you and me.
Shortly after Idlib city, the provincial capital, was captured, an order was sent, and I've been told this by the leaders of three of the Free Syrian Army organisations that subsequently became involved, was that they received an order from the operations room in Turkey, which is staffed also by the US, by the UK, by Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. They received an order to begin to integrate themselves operationally in Idlib.
What? Can we hear that again? Integrate themselves operationally? We have just learnt that the Free Syrian Army, regarded as moderate by the West, integrated itself with al-Qaeda at Idlib. And consider this. If what Charles Lister was told is true, it did not do so on its own accord. It did so on orders from a control room in Turkey, which was supported by the West.
So what then followed was a period of several months whereby these Free Syrian Army organisations cooperated very, very closely on the ground with Ahrar al-Sham, with al-Nusra. But they never admitted this cooperation in public. But I made frequent visits to Turkey to meet with different armed groups at the time, and I was continuously told by these groups, yes, of course we're fighting. Of course we're fighting with Jaish al-Fatah.
Let's sum up what we've learnt so far. One, equipment supplied by the West has an unfortunate habit of ending up in the hands of jihadis. Two, Western-sponsored rebels fight alongside al-Qaeda. As for Britain's role in that Turkish control room, it's believed to be minor. The Foreign Office didn't respond to our inquiries, so here's what Robert Ford, former US ambassador to Syria, told me when I asked him about whether the allies of the West had been supporting al-Nusra.
There is a difference between giving material assistance and cooperating tactically on the ground. The Nusra Front did capture some equipment after fighting, but I am not aware that any groups the Americans have ever helped have turned over willingly equipment or finances to the Nusra Front. Tactical cooperation in battles? Absolutely. Providing direct material assistance? I haven't seen it.
Refusal to intervene directly in Syria has had one unhappy consequence. The West has allowed regional powers to find their own ways of bringing down Assad. We have this on the authority of a figure no less than the US Vice President Joe Biden, who produced this amazing observation.
Our biggest problem is our allies.
Mr. Biden later apologized for the speech, in which he went on to say that
the Turks, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. What were they doing? They were so determined to take down Assad. What did they do? They poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and the extremist elements of jihadis coming from other parts of the world. Now, you think I'm exaggerating? Take a look.
So here is the U.S. Vice President, a famous expert on foreign policy and recipient of top-level intelligence briefings. It appears that Vice President Biden might have received a visit from the Thought Police, because almost at once he issued a series of apologies to America's allies across the Middle East. But it was too late. His words had gone global. The United States of America and al-Qaeda are on the same side, at least when it comes to fighting Assad. It should come as no surprise, then, to learn that serious attempts are being made to rebrand al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, as people you can do business with. Charles Lister has been following their progress through his meetings with other opposition forces over the past 3 years.
Increasingly now, there appears to be a recognition that al-Nusra is not your typical al-Qaeda affiliate. And in many respects, some of these Gulf countries are talking that al-Nusra Front can be dealt with. They are someone that we can talk to. They are someone that we can try and manage. And what we've seen in the last probably 6 to 9 months is an attempt, particularly by Qatar and Turkey, to persuade al-Nusra to cancel their allegiance to al-Qaeda and thereby become a more legitimate Syrian opposition group.
This attempt to make al-Qaeda respectable appears to be working. While Osama bin Laden was obliged to communicate mainly by VHS cassette recordings passed via secret couriers to select journalists, the head of al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate is becoming an accomplished media performer. He gave a press conference, admittedly to only a handful of journalists, last week. He has also given 2 lengthy sit-down interviews to Al Jazeera Arabic, most recently in May this year. The key message from Nusra chief Abdul Muhammad al-Julani was that al-Qaeda won't use Syria as a base for international jihad. And his message is getting through to Britons fighting with al-Qaeda. Sukunda Kamani, a reporter for BBC's Newsnight, has regular conversations over social media with foreign fighters in Syria.
I think they still see their role as being within an international jihad, but they definitely say that their focus is on removing Assad. And they believe that at the moment, certainly, that there's no justification or no reason to be doing attacks in the West. And part of that is ideological, and part of it is also pragmatic.
The Syrian branch of al-Qaeda remains a murderous and thoroughly unpleasant organisation, but it is trying to present a human face. Charles Lister.
This new kind of thinking focused on playing a very long strategic game, presenting itself as a support to a repressed community. In fact, that is their very name, al-Nusra Front, the support front. So, for example, early on in the conflict in Aleppo City, the al-Nusra Front offered to take control of all of the city's bakeries. And essentially what they did was they at least halved the price of bread, which is probably the staple food. Previously, Free Syrian Army commanders would take half of the production every morning and send it to their fighters for free. And it's that kind of trying to gain a relationship of trust and loyalty with local populations that has really seen them sow those durable roots, which means we're going to face an extremely difficult challenge in the future to push this organization out of Syria.
And this caring side to al-Qaeda is finding an echo on British streets. BBC Newsnight, Sukunda Kamani.
You have people, some of them, who are actually a lot less supportive of general, let's say, terrorist activity, and who just believe that Nusra are a good force and fighting against what is undoubtedly a real oppression by Bashar al-Assad. And so because of that, there's a lot more people who are sympathetic towards them in Britain.
And wait for this.
People like that have even told me that they would oppose attacks in the UK so much that they would do whatever they could to prevent that, even if that meant at times cooperating with the authorities.
Crikey, that's amazing. So there are al-Nusra supporters in Britain, al-Qaeda in Britain, you're saying, who tell you that they actually report a planned atrocity in British streets.
It's a bit hard to define what an al-Nusra supporter is. There's no membership badge, but there are certainly people who are supportive of al-Nusra who would completely oppose attacks in Britain and have said that they would do what they could to stop that.
We have discovered no evidence that Britain or America is deliberately supporting al-Qaeda, but war notoriously creates strange bedfellows. The terrible and tragic Syrian civil conflict can be interpreted as a series of proxy wars. Saudi Arabia versus Iran, Sunni versus Shia Islam, and a reopening of the old Cold War between the United States and Russia. But it's also a struggle between secularism and religious tolerance, admittedly in the context of bloodstained dictatorship, and a virulent brand of Saudi-backed jihad. Anyone who knows their history shouldn't be too surprised to learn that Britain and the West have ended up on the same side as the jihadis.
This edition of The Report was presented by Peter Oborne and produced by me, Joe Kent. You can find more editions of the programme on our website, and if you liked what you've heard, why not try the Five Live Investigates podcast?